Well, I'd like to welcome you to a local folk radio show.
Thank you, Steve.
Yes. I just want to talk. Did you always grow up with folk music? Did you grow up with it?
I think I was born with a folk music gene. As a child, the first music that caught my attention was folk music. At the Hampton Beach Amateur Hour, I sang Clementine, I think when I was five.
You sang Clementine?
Clementine.
What were the other people singing?
Oh, pop music.
Pop music?
Yeah, this was... Some people danced, some sang, some played instruments. It was a local summer thing at Hampton Beach.
Wait, how old... What year was this about?
But 1945.
1945, okay.
46, yeah.
1945, 46, and you were young, and people were doing... And what were they singing? What were they doing in the 40s? War music?
A lot of Andrew Sisters stuff.
A lot of Andrew Sisters? And
yeah,
what?
And again, a lot of just old-time favorites kind of stuff. Yeah. They kept in their piano bench.
They kept in their piano bench. Did your family have a piano?
Oh, yes.
Did you stand around the piano and play music?
No.
No.
I took lessons for 7 years. But again, that had been a tradition with a lot of my relatives playing piano.
Yep.
And one of my aunts had a really full piano bench. And again, a lot of the music books I got out, I started going toward the tunes that were called folk songs, largely English, Scottish, and a couple Welsh. I could play them on the piano, but you can't carry a piano with you everywhere you go.
No, not at all. Okay, so but you found this music originally in the piano bench?
Some of it you'd hear on the radio, because back then there was radio drama. For example, there was a radio version of Robin Hood. There was a radio version of Sherlock Holmes.
Nice.
And I'm trying to think those who use folk tune themes. Greensleeves, I think, was the background for Robin Hood.
Really?
Oh, even the television show later used folk themes as the background.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, it wasn't like nowadays where you're hard-pressed to find any folk music.
Yeah. It is difficult. And again, back then, there was no folk music per se. It was just hanging around. There were still older people who knew the old songs.
Yeah. And did you know them?
My grandfather. Yeah. He didn't sing a lot of songs. The only one I vaguely remember was a version of the Frog and the Mouse.
The Frog and the Mouse?
The courting song, yeah.
I think I know that one.
Well, there's a lot of them to know.
Yeah.
the first that showed up in Complaint of Scotland, publication 1580-something.
Okay.
And then spread around all over the English-speaking world.
But at the time, these publications that you're talking about, what are those exactly? Did you just say publication number 15-something?
No. I've forgotten what I was. This happens when you get old.
Well, that's all right. So you were... Okay, so I'm just trying to get a feel. I mean, obviously it was more prevalent, and nowadays, you know, I mean, you have to really seek it out.
Yeah.
But... that was, oh, here we go. The 101 best songs right here by the cable company.
That's the kind of thing, yeah. That's a songster called Songsters.
Songsters?
Yeah, there are some people who collect those exclusively.
These are called Songsters. Okay, so this is where you'd go and find your music.
You might. A lot of them were, America's favorite songs.
I've heard of that before.
There's a lot of books titled that. Somebody else decided what our favorites were.
I just need to tell my listeners right now that I'm looking at these two little paperback books. One's called Twice 55 Community Songs for Treble Voices, and the other one's called The 101 Best Songs. 101 Best Songs, huh? Okay. Did you ever sing anything from this?
I don't know. Those are recent editions.
Okay. Revised 29th edition. But.
And again, when I started singing, it wasn't from those kind of books.
Well, did you learn the folk tradition from the folk tradition, where it's listening, finding and listening?
Actually, the first time I get into folk music was two very important albums, English Street Songs by A.L. Lloyd and Bad Lads and Hard Cases by Ewan McCall.
What was the Ewan McCall one called?
Bad Lads and Hard Cases.
Bad Lads and Hard Cases.
Yeah. Hard Cases, sort of a problem person in England. A criminal.
Oh, okay.
And they were fascinating albums. I just kept listening and learning. And again, I learned some songs there.
So they were records?
Yeah.
Okay.
Both on Riverside back then. Riverside was the main source for folk music, certainly British folk music, other than Folkways, which has always been the premier label.
Okay. For all other things folk?
All things folk, international. Moses Ash recorded almost anything he heard and put it out.
So were these albums sort of like source material, would you call them? Or?
Yes. McCall and Lloyd were first, really two of the first revival singers of any note. A.L. Lloyd had some songs from when he was a boy, spent time in Australia, learned a lot of songs there collecting. He did learn some songs I know from print, from old manuscripts, old broadsides. He worked a lot with Ralph Vaughan Williams. Together they put out the Penguin Book of English Folk Songs. Ewan McCall started his career as an actor, very well-known actor and playwright. He picked up songs from his parents and their friends. There was a sort of a mini Scottish community in England where they were living in parts of Manchester.
Okay.
And the songs that he got, the Scottish songs, are just amazing.
Well, how was it that who introduced you to these albums?
My father gave me those two as a birthday present, knowing I had an interest in English music and English culture.
Well, how did you decide that? What made you interested in English culture?
King Arthur, Robin Hood, and a lot of old folk tales.
I see. Okay, so you were interested in those old knights and all that.
Exactly.
Okay, and so your dad said, hey, look, I got you these albums, and they're Scottish.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's super cool. So you learned them, but that was I'm looking at something right here, that some recordings that happened back in the 70s, but you were listening to this music in the 40s, you said?
No, the 50s when I was in high school.
Okay, so that's more the 50s when they were in high school. Now, this is, were the Clancys out then or anything? Was this stuff becoming popular? Were you?
The Clancys were still in the background. They, among collectors and serious scholars, Tommy Makem's mother was well known as a source singer.
As a source singer.
Yeah, she's one of the people that's where the song came from. Like The Little Beggar Man was hers.
The Little Beggar Man.
Yeah.
Hey, I sing that now, so.
Yeah, she kept that alive until Tommy took it up and brought it over here. His appearance in Newport was rather important.
In the Newport Folk Festival?
Yeah. As far as bringing the Irish tradition, because before the Clancys and Tommy got going here and in Ireland, most people were just, all they knew was Arthur Godfrey's St. Patrick's Day or Bing Crosby singing Irish songs.
That's right.
Mostly written by Americans.
Well, that's pretty, even nowadays, I had a fellow that I worked with who was talking about, hey, if you want to learn some Irish songs, this is a Bing Crosby album.
Yeah.
So who put the chowder in the shorts and the chowder?
No, but the overalls and Mrs. Murphy's chowder.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Nobody answered, so I shouted all the louder. That's an Irish trick, that's true. And I can lick the Mick who threw those overalls and Mrs. Murphy's chowder.
So, yeah, that's what he said I needed to listen to if I wanted to learn those. Okay, so those are the ones. But, I mean, how did you feel about those songs? I mean, you had already been listening to
them. I enjoyed them because a lot of them had some really nice tunes.
Okay.
Most of them had horrible words.
Yeah.
Silly words.
Well, the chowder sounded silly.
Oh, it's sort of a music hall type song, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you like those music hall type songs, though? I mean,
oh yeah, they're very good. John Roberts and Tony Barron did a music hall production some years ago with other people that I saw once on television. Just wonderful.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting about that is, I mean, there's a pretty big difference between that music hall stuff and what you would call, you know, real Irish music or music?
Well, yes and no. Remember, sailors oftentimes would go to the music halls when on shore. They might bring a song back from a music hall.
Okay.
And it might go into the folk tradition. A good example is, I'll come back to it, I can't think of it right now. Well, Strike the Bell was originally a semi-religious song by Henry Clay Work, who also wrote The Grandfather's Clock. And Strike the Bell was originally Strike the Bell Watchman, and was more religious. Then it went to sea, then it went to Australia, called There Click Go the Shears.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I mean, I heard that Strike the Bell was a parody song.
Yeah. It was taken from a religious song and just new words put to it.
I love it. Yeah. But normally, nowadays, when we see those things, well, I mean, well, I don't know. Some are good or some are bad. Strike the Bell was a really good one, though, eh?
Yeah.
Now, did you have a folk club in high school or college?
Not in high school. My debating coach was very much into folk music.
Okay. But it wasn't like you were going...
They didn't have folk music clubs back then.
Because it was too early.
Yeah, but when I got to college, I met a lot of people who sang folk songs, who played instruments, and we'd get together every Saturday night in the basement of the Women's Union and share songs.
So, similar to what we think of when we think of a coffee house or something nowadays, sort of like in the basement of a church, you know.
Well, more like what they used to call hootenannies.
Is that what they used to call hootenannies?
That's what the kind of thing was, where people would just sing in circles.
So, but what we do down at the press room on Friday is not a hootenanny?
Not really. It's a session. The terms have changed.
The terms have changed.
Yeah.
But it's kind of similar?
Yeah. I forgot if it was Woody or Pete who probably coined the word hootenanny, but they used to have them in New York. And they'd get there and sing and invite other people to come up on stage and sing. When the coffee houses first opened up in New York and Boston with folk music, they would all run what they called a hoot night. In fact, the night of the press from Tuesday was called the hoot night originally.
The Friday night set?
The Tuesday night.
Oh, but, well, now we call the open mic night the hoot.
That's right, it was.
Okay.
It was. And what would happen, the club would have the hoot, and you'd go in there and say, I'd like to play. And you'd go downstairs and somebody would audition you. And unless you were horrible, they'd give you a slot.
unless you were horrible.
Yeah.
Now they just give you the slot anyways.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit different. I mean, it really transitioned. When did you start doing the press room session? What year
we don't know. Approximately 30 years ago, when Jay Smith got the liquor license, it was called a ballroom license, still is. You don't have to serve food, but you have to have live entertainment. And so he got Eddie Dale to fill all the nights with the different musicians. And I started out doing Tuesday nights. And that went on for a while.
It was Celtic night? Or
No, this was just... It was a happy hour.
Happy hour.
Yeah.
So just anything?
Whatever I wanted to do. Bob Frost came up a few times. He was working in Boston then. And then at some point, Stanley Longstaff, who was doing Fridays, had to quit because he got a straight job. And Jay asked me to take over Fridays.
Okay.
And again, Bob Frost used to come up once in a while. He and I have been playing together since 1970. But, and then a sailor came in one night for a beer and said, Gee, can I bring my banjo next week? I said, sure, come on in. And then Dave Bem started coming down to join us.
And this was 30 years ago or somewhere around then?
Yeah.
And at that point, you were just playing whatever. You weren't saying to yourself, hey, I want to. I mean, you were definitely doing folk music.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now you were already an expert at folk music by the time that happened. I mean, had you been going to, were there folk festivals that you'd been going to?
Not so much festivals. I'd played every club in Boston.
Okay, you'd done the coffee house
circuit, yeah. And I was the third weekend at the Stone Church.
Oh, really? The third weekend at the Stone
Church?
Yeah,
Bob. That's why I met Bob Frost.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
Yeah, my friends Bill Madison and Chris Beege. And a snowstorm came by my house in Stratum and said, hey, there's a new pub open in Newmarket. You want to come?
A new pub in Newmarket.
I said, I'm not going out in the snow. So next thing I know, Arnie Taylor called me and come over to the house and see if I wanted to play.
Yeah.
And I said, sure. So I ended up playing, I think, the first Saturday after New Year's. Jamie Brockett did the opening weekend. Bill Madison did the second one. And the Friday night there did one set. And Frost was there to have some beer with his workmates. And came up and said, gee, I think I could play some of the stuff on my banjo. I said, well, bring it with you tomorrow night. I've got it with me right now.
Cool.
And there it started.
So really, this you getting together and playing this music around in this area started more at the Stone Church.
It actually started at the New World Gallery, which is a coffee house down on Daniel Street.
Okay, okay.
And that's where folk music really started in Portsmouth.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I played there. The only other people who still play music who played there from New Hampshire were the Shaw Brothers.
Okay.
And again, that was still when they were the Brandywine Singers. But Danny Gravis, who played there a lot, was a really great singer, started bringing up his friends from Boston and bringing the Portsmouth people down to Boston. So that's how I got to Bill Staines came up there, Chris Smither, Nancy Michaels, Paul Jeremiah. Then I met some more of them down in Boston.
So you were bringing people up here from the Boston scene?
Not more and more. Danny was doing that.
Okay.
And the Boston scene sort of collapsed in 1970. There weren't many coffee houses. The money was awful.
Yeah.
And one friend of ours, Eddie Bourne, had discovered cheap rents in Plum Island. And then the migration began north.
Cheap rents.
Cheap rents, summer rentals, winter rentals.
It.
Yeah. And a lot of singers came up. And the Grog has been open at that time.
Yeah.
I played the Grog before Richard owned it. And shortly after the Stone Church opened. And the scene was being revived again.
But in Portsmouth.
In Portsmouth and Newmarket. Stone Church was very important in those days.
Oh, yeah?
A lot of people got to start there. Bill Morrissey started there. In fact, he did his first recording in the parlor in my house in Epping.
Oh, yeah? This house that we're sitting in?
No.
Sorry, we're not even in Epping.
No.
Then are we?
This is Nottingham.
This is Nottingham, okay. Yeah. Excuse me.
It's all right. New Hampshire, they're all the same.
Seems like it. So when you were doing, how old were you when you started doing this? Started doing these really being involved in the scene.
In college, I was probably 19 when I started there. 21, I was teaching private school, doing a little performing with one friend who played banjo. Going to a few concerts out there, went to see Pat Sky once and Pete Seeger and the McPeak family. Bob Dylan. And then went back, got out of there, went back to Boston and took up singing there.
Now you are not you were getting paid to do it, but you had another job through. I mean, you had a career that was not folk music, didn't you?
Teaching. I did a lot of teaching, but there was time I did just folk music.
Okay, so you did both. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I learned, because literally hundreds of dollars to be made in folk music.
Yeah, really. That's what I learned, too.
Well, back then, the Turk's Head was a major club. $20 to play on any night. To get 25 of the register rang up $100 or more.
Hey, you get a piece of the till, huh?
Well, yeah, but the New World Gallery sometimes was better. They'd pass the hat. They'd have their prettiest waitress go around during every set and collect money. Could make some real money that way sometimes. Up $50 or $100, even if the crowd was good.
$50 or $100, which in today's money would be actually a lot more than that, frankly.
Yes,
right?
Because that's when you get a cheeseburger at Gilly's for a quarter.
Yeah, exactly. What'd it cost to fill your tank then?
Oh, Lord, gasoline was going for 19 cents a gallon sometimes.
Ugh. So, I mean, that's actually not that horrible, I think. I mean, it's not enough to sustain yourself.
If you could do it a couple nights a week, it was okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know if that's sustainable now, but I mean, still. So you were a teacher. Now, was it... You studied... Did you study mostly... I mean, your big interest is this English folk music, correct?
Yeah. And Scottish.
And Scottish. And it was because of the Ewan McCall and...
Yeah. And another interest, one of my best friends, when we were about 15, decided he wanted to take up the bagpipes.
Oh, the bagpipes.
Yeah, and he started playing, taught himself pretty much.
Taught himself bagpipes. That must have sounded...
He taught himself German, too.
Wow.
He's one of these self-disciplined people, yeah. Sometimes. But then he joined the Granite State Islanders. That's where I first met Pat Boyle.
Ah.
Who was about the same age as we were.
Yeah.
And there were some other people who had Scottish records. That's where I heard another couple more Ewan McCall records. And the infamous Merry Muses of Caledonia. Paul Clayton did this recording. Now, the Merry Muses was a collection of Bruin's dirty songs.
Oh, really?
Yes. The Paul Clayton one is fairly cleaned up. A year later, Ewan McCall put out a recording for Folk Lyric. They made a whole new record company to produce it in case the government came after them.
Really? What was it, anti-government?
No, obscenity.
Oh, obscenity.
There was a time when things were called obscene. And
something's still called obscene, I think.
Yes, but it's not illegal.
No, I guess not. No. No, I see. So what did you find yourself at first being academic about the music? You know, studying?
Semi, yeah. Yeah. Like every time I got a new album, the first thing I do is read the notes to learn about the song.
Okay.
And again, in those days, they had big album covers so you could see a lot of notes.
Right.
A.L. Lloyd wrote a lot of the notes for these folk albums, and they're an education by themselves. Another source back then was Sing Out magazine.
Sing Out magazine.
Yeah, it's still around. I haven't seen one for a while. But it was called the People's Song magazine. And the first one, volume one, has on it the Hammer Song.
Has the what?
The Hammer Song, If I Had a Hammer.
Oh, okay.
By Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes.
Okay.
And the early Sing Outs were very political. I've got a lot of old ones, and it's like reading a political history of the 50s.
Really?
50s and early 60s. Red scares, witch hunts, McCarthyism, the House Un-American Activities Committee, all these real right-wing groups.
What were they doing? I mean, is that what they were singing about?
Against them, yeah.
Against them, singing out against them.
Well, to give you an idea, we have had a friend named Bess. She's a bit older than I am, or was. And said when she went to college, all the only folk singers there were all communists.
Okay. Were they?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, this is something I didn't know right away.
Okay.
When I was first getting into McCall, he and Peggy Seeger were supposed to have a concert at Jordan Hall in Boston. But then I read in the paper, he'd been denied a visa because of alleged political beliefs.
Really?
And yeah, he was very, very left of center in his politics, as was Peggy and all the people they hung around with. And later, I didn't know it at the time because A.L. Lloyd never talked politics or wrote songs he had admitted to. But when his book came out, Folk Song in England, I told a friend of mine about it, and I said, it's an international book. He said, oh, he must be a communist. They don't publish anything. Unless you've got a member card. And as a result, he was allowed to go to the Eastern Bloc countries in the 50s and 60s and study the folk music there.
Oh, well, why wouldn't they? Right, but why wouldn't they let him, right? They would say, hey, this is great.
That's right. He was a party member.
Okay, so.
That gave him an in.
Yeah, all right. Well, hey, that's interesting. Cultures all over the place.
Yeah, folk music singers aren't political anymore.
Well, they don't claim to. I mean, I never came to the music because I thought there was anything political about it. But as it turns out, there's a very strong connection between politics and music.
Yeah. And again, you don't remember. A lot of people don't remember Phil Oakes.
Mm-hmm, I don't.
Great songwriter from the 60s, 70s. It's around the same time as Dylan. But so far superior to Dylan, it's incomparable.
Hmm. But you can still get an album if it's around.
He had three or four albums out. He committed suicide.
Oh, that's too bad.
To say shame, yeah.
Hmm. Well, nowadays, I mean, we just... I don't know. I mean, I'd like to talk... I'd like to come back, actually, in just a moment and come back and talk a little bit about... you know, music, and especially the music that you do now, and how you came from, you know, your where you've gone to where you are now. But I'll just come back in just a minute.
Okay.
We're listening to Tom Hall. This is Local Folk. I'm your host, Steve Carrigan, and we will be right back. Okay. Welcome back, Tom. For my listeners, you're listening to Local Folk. I'm your host, Steve Carrigan, and I have with me Tom Hall, who has been running, among other things, has been running the session at the press room on Friday nights, the traditional music session, for around 30 years. And from that session have evolved... the session's really been a hub for many musicians. There have been many bands. The Angel Band, for example, my band, Great Bay Sailor, Dave Halwell's band. I mean, many bands. Oran Moore and Mudhook, and these are the ones that London Julie. I mean, these are the ones that I know of. But, you know, even before that, I'm sure there was a bunch of bands that were happening that sort of came out from there. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about your music. You have a CD. I have the CD in front of me, Tom Hall, a Bottle Full for the Shantymen, traditional sailor songs. And I wanted to ask you about that. What you said that you were mostly studying English and Scottish music, so why is it that you made this kind of
Well,
music?
On by Bert Lloyd's album, English Street Songs. Mm-hmm. There were some sailor songs on there, four bitters, and they were really neat. And then later his English Drinking Songs album had a couple more. And when I started college, a friend I made there had an album called Blow Boys Blow. Mm-hmm. That was the seminal shanty album for most people of my generation.
Okay.
Where the songs originally by the Source Singers were there. It was McCall, Lloyd. I know Ralph Rinsler on mandolin. I'm not sure who else was playing, but it was a really great production.
Okay. So you said... this is not political. We were just sitting here talking about all the politics of all of this music, and yet I don't consider the shanty music to be political.
Well, it usually really isn't. They're work songs. So there's a sense there. You know, the sailors would tell you how rough the work is. They were driven hard because they were put on those ships to make a good time. That was the shantyman's main job in the 19th century. Keep the men working hard and fast so the owners made more money.
Okay.
There's an interesting wailing song called The Eclipse. Mm-hmm. And the ship went out in Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, and it only caught one whale. A couple others didn't catch any, and so the owners cut the whalers' pay, even though the jawbones of this whale are still on display at the British Museum. It was that big.
Oh, so they caught one humongoid whale.
And there's a song, The Eclipse. We'll tell them that we'll never sign again for 1 and 3, but isn't we good? Because we didn't get fair play in this year of the Jubilee.
And this is on the song The Eclipse?
It's the song is The Eclipse. It's on the album Leviathan.
How many folk songs do you know?
I made a list. Started making a list.
Yeah.
Some 5 or 10 years before I met Lynn. I stopped at around 800.
800. Because, you know, I'm also looking at, just for you listeners out there, I have a list of a DVD's worth of songs and MP3s. There are many, many performances and many, many recordings here. Hey, cruising around Yarmouth, I know some of these. And there's so many of them, and yet there's so 800 songs, because I'm looking at this CD, I don't see the Eclipse on here. You know,
no.
But you decided not to. Where'd you collect all these? Just from
a lot of those came from mainly Burt Lloyd, Neil Lloyd. I'm named Lloyd McCall recordings.
Okay.
Later, I picked up some stuff by the Critics Group, which is a bunch of singers that McCall and Seeger put together. That's where I got Radcliffe Highway. I think that's the only one I took up there. Maybe another, but I can't remember it.
These guys, are they all in cahoots with one another? I mean, you keep talking about the British guys and the English guys getting together.
Oh, yes. The English folk music in the 50s. McCall and Lloyd were very important. Alan Lomax, American, was over there, and he was very influential. Hamish Henderson was the director of the School of Scottish Studies. He wrote the I can't think of the tune. It's a Farewell to the Greeks of Sicily. Farewell to Sicily.
Farewell to Sicily.
Yeah. And a few others. And also at the time, there was the BBC was producing folk music programs, and Lloyd did work there. And Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger and Charles, I can't think of his name, he's not mainly a singer, started putting together these radio ballads in which they take a line of work or particular kind of people and put together a documentary about the life. And Ewan would write songs to go along with this narration.
About the life of a particular person.
Well, for example, Singing the Fishing, largely based on Sam Larner, an old fisherman. The song Shoals of Herring is essentially about Larner. It's his biography.
I see.
And McCall had those charts in his room, so he'd go and pinpoint exactly every place that Sam had mentioned.
Wow.
Then later they did one about the traveling people. Just call the traveling people, who to us are known as gypsies. But they are a much maligned class of people everywhere in the world. And this,
why?
They're not like everybody else. They don't settle down. Yet they are one of the greatest sources in Britain, certainly, of folk music.
Well, I mean, there's the Ewan McCall song that Tony Giblin just recorded, the 30-foot trailer.
Yeah, that was from the Traveling People radio ballad. But we've got a whole volume of songs that Ewan and Peggy collected just from Traveling People. There's another fella I sort of know on through Mudgat in England. Jim, but that's what he's doing now, is collecting in Ireland. Traveling people.
So do you suggest that people... I have a question. Do you suggest that people seek out this music that you're talking about? Or, I mean...
Yes.
Okay.
I think a problem a lot of younger singers have today is they don't go back far enough. You know, folk song, especially those that weren't written down till this century, it's like an old photocopy. Every time you make a new one, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So people forget verses, make mistakes, change the songs, usually for the worse. But again, the availability is not always easy. Anything done on Folkways is available. Folkways records do not go out of print. They're run by the Smithsonian now. Most record companies are available on CD. I went for years without a CD player because I said, they'll never put what I want on CDs. Yeah.
Well, they do now. I mean,
yeah, well, for example, Prestige, which did some wonderful albums, not a thing on CD. That's where they lived. Sailor's Garland, another source of mine for songs, sea songs. That's it. They weren't reproduced anywhere else. The best of Ewan McCall, the best of Jeannie Robertson, the best of Faye Lloyd. These were all Prestige albums. They are gone, unless you've got a copy of it.
You have a copy of them?
A lot of them, yeah. Never got the best of Ewan McCall or the one of Jeannie Robertson.
Now, when you did these songs, you collected them from people like Ewan McCall. Now, do you feel that you adapted them, or did you? How did you approach recording these?
What I did in that case, I tried to put together what Frost and I had done in programs, is a voyage. Where the first song is about setting a sail, weighing anchor, unfurling the sails, and getting off to sea, and then it ends. Coming back into home port.
Okay.
And go through forebitters and shanties. Try to represent most kinds.
That's very interesting that was your theme was in this particular album for the Shantymen was there's 21 songs on here. And so they're telling the story of a sea journey.
Pretty much, yeah. I tried to.
Okay. But you tried to take the song just as it was and reproduce it, but just with your own voice.
My own voice, yeah. And concertina or a guitar. And again, when you can't help over the years, but you're changing one or two words in a traditional song because you sing it once. And the next time you sing it, you say, Jesus, did I sing it that way? Did I sing this word? And before I know if you don't, you're stuck with a word that wasn't in the original song, and you learned it.
Happens all the time.
Yeah. And again, if the word you use instead works, you don't worry about it.
Well, what do you think about people that are trying to reach out to somebody? Because I feel like if somebody's used to listening to Top 40 music or something, and then they go find an old Ewan McCall album, they're going to go, I don't know about this. This, you know.
Again, Ewan McCall is better to start with than A.L. Lloyd.
Okay.
A.L. Lloyd was just a wonderful singer, but he does not have the kind of voice that one takes to right away. In fact, it took me a while to get used to him. Especially, I've got one set of records of child ballads, and they're all unaccompanied McCall and Lloyd. And I was playing in my college room one day, and the maid was coming through, and I thought she was terrified when Lloyd started singing.
This was even back then.
Yeah.
When they were playing a lot of folk music.
Again, the folk shows started on the radio.
Right.
In the mid-60s.
So do you? So do you? How do you feel about the fact that folk music is now sort of subculture as opposed to something that's more mainstream?
It always was.
It always was. Okay.
Except among the folk. These are songs that people would sing for their families, their friends, or at work. And that's all they needed. They weren't doing it for money necessarily.
Right.
Maybe a couple free pints at the pub.
No, that's as good as money.
Yeah. Or a meal. Didn't matter.
So, where do you think it's going to go? Where do you think the folk music's going from here?
I think it's going to survive. Despite the attempt by some people not to let it.
There are people out there that are trying to make that not happen?
Not consciously.
Yeah.
Especially there are some singer-songwriters who think they are so much better.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. They're awful. And a lot of people also play around with traditional songs and change them. And again, that's okay if you can improve on it and don't change the meaning or the sense. But too many people just do it so they can make the tune prettier, make the arrangement fancier, and also claim a copyright
for
their version. Yeah. Now, as much as I hate to condemn these people, mm-hmm. when the Clancys and Tommy Mangum published their first book of songs, the copyright was on 90% of them. Even this thing I pointed out that they sang South Australia word for word, note for note, and in the same key as Lloyd McCall did it.
Oh, yeah, right.
And they had not adapted or arranged it.
Mm-hmm. Which you would think was a good thing.
Yeah. And again, speaking of copyright, A.L. Lloyd wrote a lot of traditional songs that are just coming to light these days. He never took credit for it. He just passed them off as, oh, I learned this from an old fisherman.
Oh, I see.
They say, oh, can we meet him? No, he died. This one you might recognize. Susan does it. The Recruited Collier. Lloyd put that together from another song.
He put it together from another song?
Yep.
So it's always adapting a little bit then.
Yeah. And again, peep, the folk used to do it. Take, for example, what's the song? Very well-known sea song. Oh, Will Ratton Will Roar.
Right. I've heard several of that.
Well, there's an American one that people got from Burl Ives.
Okay.
I've heard a Newfie version. There's an Australian version. And all over the world.
Oh, it's an English version. Do you know the Nantucket version? Is that the one that...
Yeah, that's the one Burl Ives came up with.
Oh, is that right? Okay, okay.
And again, the Takawana Girls is the English one. And there are a few others like that, but that's the most common one that comes to mind.
What about a song like Tanqueray Martinio?
That's a fun song once in a while. Was that John Campbell?
I think it's John Campbell.
He's a fisherman, songwriter. He's written some really good stuff. Many humorous songs and lighthearted songs and silly songs are really nice once a year.
What? That's why you need to know like 800 of them.
No. There are a lot of serious songs you can do every week. But I'm talking about silly songs. I mean, that pirate song.
Oh, it's a part of being a pirate?
Yes.
The Camp of the Pirates, all
I've
the
heard that farmin too many times already.
F word.
Oh, the F word's another terrible thing.
Another
it's
terrible thing.
It's funny once. You want to have forgotten it.
Well, no F word on this show. Hey, but we'll give you the last word. If somebody wants to come in, though, and sing something, you know, down at the press room on a Friday night, you know, what would you suggest that they do in order to get ready for that? I mean...
Come in and listen one or two Fridays.
Okay.
See what's going on. Kevinson did that. Scanlon.
Yes.
He came in and listened several times. Bruce McIntyre did that. Then they brought in a guitar and tried doing something, and it's because the session, like any session, is its own beast. Mm-hmm. It has its eccentricities, its quirkiness, and its people, some of whom are weird from time to time. So if you come in and listen for a while and see what goes on, talk to me, talk to the singers.
Okay.
Everybody's always happy to talk to somebody.
Certainly. All right. Well, on that note, we have to get going here on Local Folk. But if you do have the chance, come on down to the press room on a Friday night. Listen to what's going on. I've been speaking with Tom Hall, who started this session over 30 years ago on a Friday night. And we hope for another 30 years in any, some one form or another, I'm sure. But for now, thanks a lot for coming
on
the show.
Thank you, Steve. I'm honored.
Oh, thank you very much. And we'll see you guys next week on Local Folk.